In what sense was it the medieval versus the modern?
Britain at the time was the only superpower in the world. The United States was not yet a superpower. And China, despite its incredible history of innovations, they invented 500 years or more before us, paper currency, coal for burning, I could go on and on and on, history writing, among other things. But technologically, they were very backward, and they were using 200-year-old weapons, including bows and arrows, against Britain, which had a precursor of the machine gun called Armstrong rockets, which, instead of shooting bullets, shot a zillion arrows at a time. And also, the Second Opium War was the first time that steamships were introduced in battle, 10 years before the Civil War, the battle between the Monitor and the Merrimack. And against these steamships, the Chinese used the aptly named junks, which were powered by sail, and they didn't stand a chance. The strangest, and again, this is farcical if it weren't tragic, is that all along the waterways in China, there were forts with cannons, and the cannons were bolted to the fort, and they couldn't raise or lower the barrel of the cannons. And so as the British warships sailed by or steamed by, the Chinese would fire the cannons, but since they couldn't aim them, the cannonballs went over the top of the masts of the ship. And they were so ineffective that one of the commanders sat on the deck sunning himself while Chinese cannons fired over the heads of the masts.
So the battles were very lopsided.
Right. Sounds like a Cheech and Chong costume epic, but the Chinese were so stoned out of their minds that during some battles, the British suffered not a single casualty. Can you imagine a battle where nobody died on one side?
So the First Opium War ends in a truce, then fighting resumes, and then there is a treaty in 1858. It's Tianjin.
Right.
What are the terms that the Chinese finally have to come to with the British?
They had to surrender the Kowloon Peninsula, which includes Hong Kong, and they also had to open up about 5 additional ports.
As I understand it, the trade was really getting bottlenecked in Canton, so the
right.
opening of more ports became a key issue.
And one of the other issues, which was less important, but they had been demanding it since 1793 when McCartney went there, was the permission to open an embassy in the capital, Peking, which is Beijing today. And finally, in 1858, the Chinese agreed. However, they didn't agree to the official legalization of opium, and the British slipped it in by saying, we are going to let you tax at 5% the following products. And they listed harmless stuff like brocades and calico and, you know, manufacture agricultural equipment and, by the way, opium. And that's how they continued to import opium despite the legal ban.
So it was de facto legalization, even though it was a
exactly.
fiction that it was still a contraband. But the 1858 treaty didn't end the war, continues for a while, continues to the gates of Peking. Can you talk about the violent end?
Right. 2 years later, in 1860, they had to sign another treaty called the Treaty or Convention of Peking, because in 1858, the emperor's courtiers signed the treaty, but the emperor refused. So the British reinvaded, or actually they just continued to invade, and they forced the emperor personally to sign the treaty, which was an incredible humiliation because his title was Son of Heaven. He was considered a god like the Japanese emperor. And to make him sign anything was just like, you know, making the Pope today fill out the IRS form. And the reason the British were so angry by 1860 at the time of the second treaty was that between the two treaties, the British sent some emissaries under flag of truce. The emperor had them imprisoned and tortured and mutilated. And in retaliation, despite the fact that the Chinese were really nasty, in retaliation, Lord Elgin, who was a Scottish earl, who was the British plenipotentiary or ambassador at the time to China, he didn't blame the Chinese people. He wanted to personally punish the emperor for torturing and killing the British POWs. He ordered the burning of the emperor's summer palace on the outskirts of Peking. And it wasn't comparable to the loss of the 2 burnings of the Library of Alexandria, which contained all the knowledge of ancient Greece, but it was certainly more of a loss than the burning of Windsor Castle in, what, 1992 or 3, because the Summer Palace, besides its magnificent architecture, its contents were even more valuable, and it included priceless, irreplaceable manuscripts, art, sculpture, the history of China, everything, and they burned it to the ground.
I was astounded to see it was 80 square miles.
It's a
huge place.
And it was beautifully landscaped. But even more important than the property was the contents. I mean, it was like burning down the Library of Congress, plus the Smithsonian, plus the New York Metropolitan Art Museum.
Well, now, you mentioned that some British leaders, like Gladstone, opposed the opium trade. You write that the leaders of the Anglican Church were opposed to the opium trade. Mm-hmm. Some of even the high officials, like Charles Eliot, the superintendent of trade, were opposed to the opium trade. Why weren't these people successful in getting Britain to put a stop to the opium trade in China?
For the same reason we still don't have universal, free, affordable health care. The opium lobby was incredibly powerful because the opium merchants were very rich and they could afford to pay the very best lobbyists, and the lobbyists dominated Parliament.
Who were William Jardine and James Matheson?
The East India Company had a monopoly on the opium trade until 1832, when the monopoly was removed because the East India Company was corrupt, plus everybody else wanted to get into the business. And once they lost their monopoly, the vacuum was filled by everybody who was a merchant in Britain, and the most successful was the firm of Jardine, Matheson & Company.
And they became very famous in Hong Kong as a trading firm as well, didn't they?
Yes, they were the Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, and Donald Trump rolled into one of the day.
You quote a press release from Jardine Matheson, which says, quote, "Opium is not a curse, but a comfort and a benefit to the hardworking Chinese," close quote.
What can I say? It's the same drug companies that push drugs that turn out to cause heart attacks.
Well, now the British won the war. They get de facto legalization of the opium trade in China. What happens to opium imports to China in the years following 1860?
It only got worse because originally opium could only be grown in India because of the climate. By the end of the 19th century, the Chinese figured out how to grow it locally, which meant it was cheaper and therefore more plentiful.
You quote that in the 20 years following the war, that the imports actually doubled. You give a figure of 105,000 chests of opium. I think that's, you say, 170 pounds per chest. And I did
Correct.
Some quick calculations. 18 million pounds of opium. It's a heck of a lot of opium. And
right.
That would be in 1 year in 1879. So this solved both the sterling trade deficit problem, and it also solved a big hole in the British budget by providing them with extraordinary amount of revenues.
Right. Before they started importing opium into China, the British Treasury was paying for tea 39,000 pounds, and the Chinese were only paying 7,000 pounds. And before they started selling opium, the British were literally going broke, and they were desperate. And they finally, as I said, found something besides silver, which the Chinese were willing to pay for in return for tea. Another problem was that the Chinese not only would only accept silver, but they would only accept silver Spanish dollars, which were the American dollars of the era. And because of wars between Spain and Britain, Britain didn't have access to Spanish dollars. So even if they had wanted to pay for the tea with silver, they couldn't while the wars were going on. One was the American Revolution, and the other was the Napoleonic Wars, in which Spain was allied with France.
The legacy of the Opium Wars goes on in the 20th century, and you're right that in the 1920s and 30s, Chiang Kai-shek was financing his army with opium taxes. This is a general supported by the United States in his struggle with the communists.
Well, what can I say? During the Vietnam War, this is a well-known fact, the CIA imported heroin into Southeast Asia to finance the war as well, but even worse, during World War II, after the Japanese occupied a huge portion of China, they were passing out free heroin because an intoxicated population was a docile population. So as if the Chinese didn't have enough problems with opium, they were also being poisoned by the Japanese with an even more addictive drug, heroin.
In the aftermath of World War II, Mao and the communists come to power in China. What does he do about the opium addiction problem in 1949?
Okay, far from it, for me to be an apologist for a genocidal tyrant like Mao. He was in one way way ahead of his time and shared the current enlightened attitude in America that says rehabilitation rather than incarceration for drug offenders. And within 10 years of Mao coming to power, he eradicated opium. And the way he did that was by summarily executing opium dealers. No nothing. He just executed them. However, the reason he was enlightened was opium addicts who weren't selling the stuff were sent to rehabilitation facilities, but they were only given one chance. And if they relapsed, they were sent to quote-unquote re-education camps where part of the curriculum was starvation.
Well, we talked about the economic incentive, the vast profits in opium, and we talked about the cultural differences between China and Britain. Do you think if the cultural differences had been overcome, that the two countries could have come to some kind of a resolution, a peaceful resolution, which would have kept opium out? Or do you think that opium was just too profitable to forego?
The cultural differences were mostly matters of protocol. There were major political differences. China was an autocracy, and of course the U.S. is a democracy, but the real reason was money was the root of everything. It was the bottom line.
To what extent do you think that Chinese attitudes today towards the West, or the United States in particular, are affected by China's experience in the opium wars?
Let me speak about 1997, which is when the 100-year lease, the British lease of Hong Kong, which they got after the Treaty of 1860 in Peking, ended, and the British honored it and sailed away. Hong Kong at the time was the bastion of capitalism in Asia, and the people were terrified that the Chinese government, to which Hong Kong reverted, would confiscate private property. And yet, despite that fear, and also that the rich would be put into concentration camps, the way they were when Mao took over China in 1949. Despite all those fears, when Prince Charles sailed away, he showed up for the farewell ceremony. The Hong Kong people had massive celebrations because they still hated British imperialists. And their fears, as you know, turned out to be groundless for one simple reason, and the reason Communist China didn't impose socialism on Hong Kong was that the biggest investors in Hong Kong property, building and real estate, was China. They invested billions of dollars in Hong Kong, and if they had confiscated everything, the property would have become worthless. And that's why Hong Kong, except for having some political limits, and they don't have an elected parliament or Congress, that's why Hong Kong remains capitalist, because the Chinese communists would have lost a bundle if they had imposed socialism on Hong Kong.
Talking about the impact of the importation of opium into China, you made an analogy in your book to the Mexican and Colombian drug cartels in the Western Hemisphere. Could you expand on that and describe what similarities you see?
Sure. Consider this scenario, which even the most outrageous science fiction writer would never try to pull off. Imagine if the Colombian and Mexican cartels somehow got hold of an atom bomb and bombed about 10 American cities, and the Americans gave up and surrendered, and in return, the Colombians and the Mexican drug narco traffickers said, we want to have total legal and political control over the following five major cities. We don't want to pay taxes. We don't want to have any interference. And Americans are not allowed in this city without our permission. Plus, you have to pay us $5 million, which is what the British demanded in reparations as part of the terms of the Treaty of 1860. And as crazy as that sounds, that's exactly what happened after the Second Opium War.
Mr. Cinello, thanks very much for being with us today. We've been speaking with Frank Cinello, author of the Opium Wars, the addiction of one empire and the corruption of another. It's about how Britain compelled China to accept the importation of opium.
While Britain, the leading military power of the day, carried out the Opium Wars, it was not just British merchants who benefited from the lucrative opium trade. As we now know from the research of Professors Jacques Downs and Elizabeth Gray, American merchants also played a significant role in the importation of opium into China. American merchants began importing opium into China as early as the 1790s, while the British obtained their opium from India. The American merchants obtained the drug from Turkey, loaded it on their ships at Smyrna for the trip to China. Among the many American merchants participating in the opium trade in the 19th century was Stephen Girard of Philadelphia. In 1805, Girard wrote to two of his supercargo ships in the Mediterranean, quote, "I am very much in favor of investing heavily in opium." The enormous profitability in the opium trade is evidenced by the fact that when Stephen Girard died in 1831, he was and had been for 20 years the richest man in America. American opium merchants like Girard were not shadowy figures operating at the margins of society. Indeed, opium traders were prominent members of the business community and included many famous families such as the Peabodys of Massachusetts and the Astors and Delanos of New York. Opium merchant Warren Delano was grandfather of President Franklin Roosevelt. In 1839, Delano offered his support for Britain's invasion of China. Britain, he said, should, quote, "knock a little reason into the bigoted people." However, the American opium trade was not without its ironies. As Professor Gray has shown, not all the profits went into the pockets of the merchants. Indeed, many important charitable and educational institutions in America received large sums of money from opium merchants. A leading opium merchant, Thomas Perkins of Boston, became a huge philanthropist and endowed an institution to help the blind. And John C. Green, whose firm Russell & Co. dominated the opium trade by the mid-1830s, was in the 19th century the largest benefactor of Princeton University.
Thank you to Ken McDermott Rowe for that. Thank you for the extra little snippets of research about the relevance to the US. In future episodes, we're going to look into other richest men in America, oil barons, steel barons, and of course, banking barons, as we heard from Michael Hudson last week. So much easier to make money from accounting entries than it is from actually bothering to make products, shipping produce around the place. If you want to find out more about governments dealing drugs, you might want to look up Gary Webb. Episode 23 of Unwelcome Guests goes into more detail about that. And now we're going to get back to David Graeber, looking at what happened when the ruthless logic of the market, the self-maximization of profits, whatever the cost, whatever the impact on others in the real world, when that met not selling woolen goods abroad, but heading overseas, coming back with gold, slaves, and whatever else was deemed to be profitable. Now, it starts with a master dictating terms to his illiterate slave. You can think, well, more fool the slave, he shouldn't have agreed to things if he couldn't read the contract. He shouldn't put up with a master like that. Or you can think, well, isn't that pretty much what's going on today with a very small number of people who are financially powerful, if I could make such a ludicrous claim, explaining to the 99.99%, you guys can't pay your mortgage, therefore that house belongs to me. If only you'd studied harder, been better at economics, selfishly maximized a bit more, or done whatever magic I've done, you might have got to keep the house.
Chapter 11. Age of the Great Capitalist Empires, 1450 to 1971. It begins with a section from The Careta by B. Traven. 11 pesos, then, and as you can't pay me the 11 pesos, that makes another 11 pesos, 22 in all. 11 for the serape and the potato, and 11 because you can't pay. Is that right, Crisiero? Crisiero had no knowledge of figures, so it was very natural that he said, "That is right, patron." Don Anulfo was a decent, honorable man. Other landowners were a good deal less soft-hearted with their peons. The shirt is 5 pesos, right? Very well. And as you can't pay for it, that's 5 pesos. And as you remain in my debt for the 5 pesos, that's 5 pesos. And as I shall never have the money from you, that's 5 pesos. So that makes 5 and 5 and 5 and 5. That's 20 pesos. Agreed? Yes, patron, agreed. A peon can get the shirt nowhere else. When he needs one, he can get credit nowhere, but from his master, for whom he works, and from whom he can never get away, as long as he owes him a centavo. The epoch that began with what we're used to calling the Age of Exploration was marked by so many things that were genuinely new. The rise of modern science, capitalism, humanism, the nation-state, that it may seem odd to frame it as just another turn of an historical cycle. Still, from the perspective I've been developing in this book, that is what it was. The era begins around 1450, with a turn away from virtual currencies and credit economies, back to gold and silver. A subsequent flow of bullion from the Americas sped the process immensely, sparking a price revolution in Western Europe that turned traditional society upside down. What's more, the return to bullion was accompanied by the return of a whole host of other conditions that, during the Middle Ages, had been largely suppressed or kept at bay. Vast empires and professional armies, massive predatory warfare, untrammeled usury and debt peonage, but also materialist philosophies, a new burst of scientific and philosophical creativity, even the return of chattel slavery. It was in no way a simple repeat performance. All the Axial Age pieces reappeared, but they came together in an entirely new way. The 1400s are a peculiar period in European history. It was a century of endless catastrophe. Large cities were regularly decimated by the Black Death. The commercial economy sagged, and in some regions collapsed entirely. Whole cities went bankrupt, defaulting on their bonds. The knightly classes squabbled over the remnants, leaving much of the countryside devastated by endemic warfare. Even in geopolitical terms, Christendom was staggering, with the Ottoman Empire not only scooping up what remained of Byzantium, but pushing steadily into Central Europe, its forces expanding on land and sea. At the same time, from the perspective of many ordinary farmers and urban labourers, times couldn't have been much better. One of the perverse effects of the bubonic plague, which killed off about 1/3 of the European workforce, was that wages increased dramatically. It didn't happen immediately, but this was largely because the first reaction of the authorities was to enact legislation freezing wages, or even attempting to tie free peasants back to the land again. Such efforts were met with powerful resistance, culminating in a series of popular uprisings across Europe. These were squelched, but the authorities were also forced to compromise. Before long, so much wealth was flowing into the hands of ordinary people that governments had to start introducing new laws forbidding the low-born to wear silks and ermine, and to limit the number of feast days, which, in many towns and parishes, began eating up to 1/3 or even 1/2 of the year. The 15th century is, in fact, considered the heyday of medieval festive life, with its floats and dragons, maypoles and church ales, its abbots of unreason and lords of misrule. Over the next centuries, all this was to be destroyed. In England, the festive life was systematically attacked by Puritan reformers, then eventually by reformers everywhere, Catholic and Protestant alike. At the same time, its economic basis in popular prosperity dissolved. Why this happened has been a matter of intense historical debate for centuries, and this much we know. It began with a massive inflation. Between 1500 and 1650, for instance, prices in England increased 500%, but wages rose much more slowly, so that in 5 generations, real wages fell to perhaps 40% of what they had been. The same thing happened everywhere in Europe. Why? The favourite explanation, ever since a French lawyer named Jean Bonnin first proposed it in 1568, was the vast influx of gold and silver that came pouring into Europe after the conquest of the New World. As the value of precious metals collapsed, the argument went, the price of everything else skyrocketed, and wages simply couldn't keep up. There is some evidence to support this. The height of popular prosperity, around 1450, did correspond to a period when bullion, and therefore coin, was in particularly short supply. The lack of cash played havoc with international trade in particular. In the 1460s, we hear of ships full of wares forced to turn back from major ports as no one had any cash on hand to buy from them. The problem only started to turn around later that decade, with the sudden burst of silver mining in Saxony and the Tyrol, followed by the opening of new sea routes to the Gold Coast of West Africa. Then came the conquests of Cortes and Pizarro. Between 1520 and 1640, untold tons of gold and silver from Mexico and Peru were transported across the Atlantic and Pacific in Spanish treasure ships. The problem with the conventional story is that very little of that gold and silver lingered very long in Europe. Most of the gold ended up in temples in India, and the overwhelming majority of the silver bullion was ultimately shipped off to China. The latter is crucial. If we really want to understand the origins of the modern world economy, the place to start is not in Europe at all. The real story is of how China abandoned the use of paper money. It's a story worth telling, briefly, because very few people know it. After the Mongols captured China in 1271, they kept the system of paper money in place, and even made occasional, if usually disastrous, attempts to introduce it to other parts of their empire. In 1368, however, they were overthrown by another of China's great popular insurrections, and a former peasant leader was once again installed in power. During their century of rule, the Mongols had worked closely with foreign merchants, who became widely detested. Partly as a result, the former rebels, now the Ming Dynasty, were suspicious of commerce in any form. They promoted a romantic vision of self-sufficient agrarian communities. This had some unfortunate consequences. For one thing, it meant the maintenance of the old Mongol tax system, paid in labour and in kind, especially since that, in turn, was based on a quasi-caste system, in which subjects were registered as farmers, craftsmen, or soldiers, and forbidden to change their jobs. This proved extraordinarily unpopular. While government investment in agriculture, roads, and canals did set off a commercial boom, much of this commerce was technically illegal, and taxes on crops were so high that many indebted farmers began to flee their ancestral lands. Typically, such floating populations can be expected to seek just about anything but regular industrial employment. Here, as in Europe, most preferred a combination of odd jobs, peddling, entertainment, piracy, or banditry. In China, many also turned prospector. There was a minor silver rush, with illegal mines cropping up everywhere. Uncoined silver ingots, instead of official paper money, with strings of bronze coins, soon became the real money of the off-the-books informal economy. When the government attempted to shut down illegal mines in the 1430s and 1440s, their efforts sparked local insurrections, in which miners would make common cause with displaced peasants, seize nearby cities, and sometimes threaten entire provinces. In the end, the government gave up even trying to suppress the informal economy. Instead, they swung the other way entirely, stopped issuing paper money, legalized the mines, allowed silver bullion to become the recognized currency for large transactions, and even gave private mints the authority to produce strings of cash. This, in turn, allowed the government to gradually abandon the system of labor exactions and substitute a uniform tax system payable in silver. Effectively, the Chinese government had gone back to its old policy of encouraging markets and merely intervening to prevent any undue concentrations of capital. It quickly proved spectacularly successful, and Chinese markets boomed. Indeed, many speak of the Ming as having accomplished something almost unique in world history. This was a time when the Chinese population was exploding, but living standards markedly improved. The problem was that the new policy meant that the regime had to ensure an abundant supply of silver in the country, so as to keep its price low and minimize popular unrest. But, as it turned out, the Chinese mines were very quickly exhausted. In the 1530s, new silver mines were discovered in Japan, but these were exhausted in a decade or two as well. Before long, China had to turn to Europe and the New World. Now, since Roman times, Europe had been exporting gold and silver to the East. The problem was that Europe had never produced much of anything that Asians wanted to buy, so it was forced to pay in specie for silks, spices, steel, and other imports. The early years of European expansion were largely attempts to gain access either to Eastern luxuries or to new sources of gold and silver with which to pay for them. In those early days, Atlantic Europe really had only one substantial advantage over its Muslim rivals, an active and advanced tradition of naval warfare, honed by centuries of conflict in the Mediterranean. The moment when Vasco da Gama entered the Indian Ocean in 1498, the principle that the seas should be a zone of peaceful trade came to an immediate end. Portuguese flotillas began bombarding and sacking every port city they came across, then seizing control of strategic points and extorting protection money from unarmed Indian Ocean merchants for the right to carry on their business unmolested. At almost exactly the same time, Christopher Columbus, a Genoese mapmaker seeking a shortcut to China, touched land in the New World, and the Spanish and Portuguese empires stumbled into the greatest economic windfall in human history, entire continents full of unfathomable wealth, whose inhabitants, armed only with Stone Age weapons, began conveniently dying almost as soon as they arrived. The conquest of Mexico and Peru led to the discovery of enormous new sources of precious metal, and these were exploited ruthlessly and systematically, even to the point of largely exterminating the surrounding populations to extract as much precious metal as quickly as possible. As Kenneth Pomerantz has recently pointed out, none of this would have been possible were it not for the practically unlimited Asian demand for precious metals. Quote, "Had China in particular not had such a dynamic economy that changing its metallic base could absorb the staggering quantities of silver mined in the New World over 3 centuries, those mines might have become unprofitable within a few decades. The massive inflation of silver-denominated prices in Europe, from 1500 to 1640, indicates a shrinking value for the metal there, even with Asia draining off much of the supply." Unquote. By 1540, a silver glut caused a collapse in prices across Europe. The American mines would, at this point, simply have stopped functioning, and the entire project of American colonization foundered, had it not been for the demand from China. Treasure galleons moving toward Europe soon refrained from unloading their cargoes, instead rounding the Horn of Africa and proceeding across the Indian Ocean toward Canton. After 1571, with the foundation of the Spanish city of Manila, they began to move directly across the Pacific. By the late 16th century, China was importing almost 50 tons of silver a year, about 90% of its silver, and by the early 17th century, 116 tons, or over 97%. Huge amounts of silk, porcelain, and other Chinese products had to be exported to pay for it. Many of these Chinese products, in turn, ended up in the new cities of Central and South America. This Asian trade became the single most significant factor in the emerging global economy, and those who ultimately controlled the financial levers, particularly Italian, Dutch, and German merchant bankers, became fantastically rich. But how exactly did the new global economy cause the collapse of living standards in Europe? One thing we do know, it clearly was not by making large amounts of precious metal available for everyday transactions. If anything, the effect was the opposite. While European mints were stamping out enormous numbers of reals, thalers, ducats, and doubloons, which became the new medium of trade from Nicaragua to Bengal, almost none found their way into the pockets of ordinary Europeans. Instead, we hear of constant complaints about the shortage of currency. In England, quote, "For much of the Tudor period, the circulating medium was so small that the taxable population simply did not have sufficient coin in which to pay the benevolences, subsidies, and tenths levied upon them, and time again household plate, the handiest near money that people possessed, had to be surrendered." Unquote. This was the case in most of Europe. Despite the massive influx of metal from the Americas, most families were so low on cash that they were regularly reduced to melting down the family silver to pay their taxes. This was because taxes had to be paid in metal. Everyday business, in contrast, continued to be transacted much as it had in the Middle Ages, by means of various forms of virtual credit money, tallies, promissory notes, or, within smaller communities, simply by keeping track of who owed what to whom. What really caused the inflation is that those who ended up in control of the bullion, governments, bankers, and large-scale merchants, were able to use that control to begin changing the rules, first by insisting that gold and silver were money, second by introducing new forms of credit money for their own use, while slowly undermining and destroying the local systems of trust that had allowed small-scale communities across Europe to operate largely without the use of metal currency. This was a political battle, even if it was also a conceptual argument about the nature of money. The new regime of bullion money could only be imposed through almost unparalleled violence, not only overseas, but at home as well. In much of Europe, the first reaction to the price revolution and the accompanying enclosures of common lands was not very different from what had so recently happened in China. Thousands of one-time peasants fleeing or being forced out of their villages to become vagabonds or masterless men, a process that culminated in popular insurrections. The reaction of European governments, however, was entirely different. The rebellions were crushed, and this time no subsequent concessions were forthcoming. Vagabonds were rounded up, exported to the colonies as indentured labourers, and drafted into colonial armies and navies, or eventually set to work in factories at home. Almost all of this was carried out through a manipulation of debt. As a result, the very nature of debt, too, became once again one of the principal bones of contention. Part 1. Greed, Terror, Indignation, Debt. No doubt scholars will never stop arguing about the reasons for the great price revolution, largely because it's not clear what kind of tools can be applied. Can we really use the methods of modern economics, which were designed to understand how contemporary economic institutions operate, to describe the political battles that led to the creation of these very institutions? This is not just a conceptual problem. There are moral dangers here. To take what might seem an objective, macroeconomic approach to the origins of the world economy would be to treat the behavior of the early European explorers, merchants, and conquerors as if they were simply rational responses to opportunities, as if this were just what anyone would have done in the same situation. This is what the use of equations so often does, make it seem perfectly natural to assume that if the price of silver in China is twice what it is in Seville, and inhabitants of Seville are capable of getting their hands on large quantities of silver and transporting it to China, then clearly they will, even if doing so requires the destruction of entire civilizations. Or, if there is a demand for sugar in England, and enslaving millions is the easiest way to acquire labor to produce it, then it is inevitable that some will enslave them. In fact, history makes it quite clear that this is not the case. Any number of civilizations have probably been in a position to wreak havoc on the scale that the European powers did in the 16th and 17th centuries. Ming China itself was an obvious candidate, but almost none actually did so. Consider, for instance, how the gold and silver from the American mines were extracted. Mining operations began almost immediately upon the fall of the Aztec capital of Tenochtitlan in 1521. While we are used to assuming that the Mexican population was devastated simply as an effect of the newly introduced European diseases, contemporary observers felt that the dragooning of the newly conquered natives to work in the mines was at least equally responsible. In The Conquest of America, Tsvetan Todorov offers a compendium of some of the most chilling reports, mostly from Spanish priests and friars who, even when committed in principle to the belief that the extermination of the Indians was the judgment of God, could not disguise their horror at scenes of Spanish soldiers testing the blades of their weapons by eviscerating random passers-by, tearing babes off their mothers' backs to be eaten by dogs. Such acts might perhaps be written off as what one would expect when a collection of heavily armed men, many of violent criminal background, are given absolute impunity. But the reports from the mines imply something far more systematic. When Fray Toribio de Motolinia wrote of the 10 plagues that he believed God had visited on the inhabitants of Mexico, he listed smallpox, war, famine, labor exactions, taxes, which caused many to sell their children to the moneylenders, others to be tortured to death in cruel prisons, and the thousands who died in the building of the capital city. Above all, he insisted, were the uncountable numbers who died in the mines. Quote, "The 8th plague was the slaves whom the Spaniards made in order to put them to work in the mines. At first, those who were already slaves of the Aztecs were taken. Then, those who had given evidence of insubordination. Finally, all those who could be caught. During the first years after the conquest, the slave traffic flourished, and slaves often changed master. They produced so many marks on their faces, in addition to the royal brand, that they had their faces covered with letters, for they bore the marks of all who had bought and sold them. The 9th plague was the service in the mines, to which the heavily laden Indians travelled 60 leagues or more to carry provisions. When their food gave out, they died, either at the mines or on the road, for they had no money to buy food, and there was no one to give it to them. Some reached home in such a state that they died soon after. The bodies of those Indians, and of the slaves who died in the mines, produced such a stench that it caused a pestilence, especially at the mines of Oaxaca. For half a league around those mines, and along a great part of the road, one could scarcely avoid walking over dead bodies or bones, and the flocks of birds and crows that came to fatten themselves upon the corpses were so numerous that they darkened the sun." Unquote. Similar scenes were reported in Peru, where whole regions were depopulated by forced servitude in the mines, and Hispaniola, where the indigenous population was eradicated entirely. When dealing with conquistadors, we are speaking not just of simple greed, but greed raised to mythic proportions. This is, after all, what they are best remembered for. They never seem to get enough, even after the conquest of Tenochtitlan or Cuzco, and the acquisition of hitherto unimaginable riches, the conquerors almost invariably regrouped and started off in search of more treasure. Moralists throughout the ages have inveighed against the endlessness of human greed, just as they have against our supposedly endless lust for power. What history actually reveals, though, is that while humans may be justly accused of having a proclivity to accuse others of acting like conquistadors, few really act this way themselves. Even for the most ambitious of us, our dreams are more like Sinbad's, to have adventures, to acquire the means to settle down and live an enjoyable life, and then to enjoy it. Max Weber, of course, argued that the essence of capitalism is the urge, which he thought first appeared in Calvinism, never to settle down, but to engage in endless expansion. But the conquistadors were good medieval Catholics, even if ones drawn usually from the most ruthless and unprincipled elements of Spanish society. Why the unrelenting drive for more and more and more? It might help, I think, to go back to the very onset of Hernán Cortés' conquest of Mexico. What were his immediate motives? Cortés had migrated to the colony of Hispaniola in 1504, dreaming of glory and adventure, but for the first decade and a half, his adventures consisted largely of seducing other people's wives. In 1518, however, he managed to finagle his way into being named commander of an expedition to establish a Spanish presence on the mainland, as Bernal Díaz del Castillo, who accompanied him, later wrote, around this time, quote, "he began to adorn himself and be more careful of his appearance than before. He wore a plume of feathers, with a medallion and a gold chain, and a velvet cloak trimmed with loops of gold. In fact, he looked like a bold and gallant captain. However, he had no money to defray the expenses I have spoken about, for at that time he was very poor, and much in debt, despite the fact that he had a good estate of Indians and was getting gold from the mines. But all this he spent on his person, on finery for his wife, whom he had recently married, and on entertaining guests. When some merchant friends of his heard that he had obtained his command as captain general, they sent him 4,000 gold pesos in coin, and another 4,000 in goods secured on his Indians and estates. He then ordered 2 standards and banners to be made, worked in gold, with the royal arms and a cross on each side, and a legend which said, "Comrades, let us follow the sign of the Holy Cross with true faith, and through it we shall conquer." Unquote. In other words, he'd been living beyond his means, got himself in trouble, and decided, like a reckless gambler, to double down or go for broke. Unsurprising, then, that when the governor at the last minute decided to cancel the expedition, Cortes ignored him and sailed for the mainland with 600 men, offering each an equal share in the expedition's profits. On landing, he burned his boats, effectively staking everything on victory. Let us skip, then, from the beginning of Diaz's book to its final chapter. 3 years later, through some of the most ingenious, ruthless, brilliant, and utterly dishonorable behavior by a military leader ever recorded, Cortes had his victory. After 8 months of grueling house-to-house warfare, and the death of perhaps 100,000 Aztecs, Tenochtitlan, one of the greatest cities of the world, lay entirely destroyed. The imperial treasury was secured, and the time had come, then, for it to be divided in shares amongst the surviving soldiers. Yet, according to Diaz, the result among the men was outrage. The officers connived to sequester most of the gold, and when the final tally was announced, the troops learned that they would be receiving only 50 to 80 pesos each. What's more, the better part of their shares was immediately seized again by the officers in their capacity of creditors, since Cortes had insisted that the men be billed for any replacement equipment and medical care they had received during the siege. Most found that they had actually lost money on the deal. Diaz writes, quote, "We were all very deeply in debt. A crossbow was not to be purchased for less than 40 or 50 pesos. A musket cost 100, a sword 50, and a horse from 800 to 1,000 pesos and above. Thus, extravagantly, did we have to pay for everything. A surgeon, who called himself Mastre Juan, who attended to some very bad wounds, charged wildly inflated fees, and so did a quack named Murcia, who was an apothecary and a barber and also treated wounds. And there were 30 other tricks and swindles for which payment was demanded of our shares as soon as we received them. Serious complaints were made about this, and the only remedy that Cortes provided was to appoint 2 trustworthy persons who knew the prices of goods and could value anything that we had bought on credit. An order went out that whatever price was placed on our purchases or the surgeon's cures must be accepted, but that if we had no money, our creditors would wait 2 years for payment." Unquote. A Spanish merchant soon arrived, charging wildly inflated prices for basic necessities, causing further outrage, until, our general becoming weary of the continual reproaches which were thrown out against him, saying he had stolen everything for himself, and the endless petitions for loans and advance pay, determined at once to get rid of the most troublesome fellows by forming settlements in those provinces which appeared most eligible for this purpose. These were the men who ended up in control of the provinces, and who established local administration, taxes, and labor regimes, which makes it little easier to understand the descriptions of Indians with their faces covered by names like so many counter-endorsed checks, or the mines surrounded by miles of rotting corpses. We're not dealing with the psychology of cold, calculating greed, but of a much more complicated mix of shame and righteous indignation, and a frantic urgency of debts, which would only compound and accumulate, and these were almost certainly interest-bearing loans, an outrage at the idea that after all they had gone through, they should be held to owe anything to begin with. And what of Cortes? He had just pulled off perhaps the greatest act of theft in world history. Certainly his original debts had now been rendered inconsequential, yet he somehow always seemed to find himself in new ones. Creditors were already starting to repossess his holdings, while he was off on an expedition to Honduras in 1526. On his return, he wrote the Emperor Charles V that his expenses were such that all I received has been insufficient to relieve me from misery and poverty, being at the moment I write in debt for upwards of 500 ounces of gold, without possessing a single peso towards it. Disingenuous, no doubt, Cortes at the time owned his own personal palace, but only a few years later he was reduced to pawning his wife's jewellery to help finance a series of expeditions to California, hoping to restore his fortunes. When those failed to turn a profit, he ended up so besieged by creditors that he had to return to Spain to petition the emperor in person. If all this seems suspiciously reminiscent of the Fourth Crusade, with its indebted knights stripping whole foreign cities of their wealth, and still somehow winding up only one step ahead of their creditors, there is a reason. The financial capital that backed these expeditions came from more or less the same place, if in this case Genoa, not Venice. What's more, that relationship between the daring adventurer on the one hand, the gambler willing to take any sort of risk, and on the other, the careful financier, whose entire operations are organized around producing steady, mathematical, inexorable growth of income, lies at the very heart of what we now call capitalism. As a result, our current economic system has always been marked by a peculiar dual character. Scholars have long been fascinated by the Spanish debates that ensued, in Spanish universities like Santander, about the humanity of the Indians. Did they have souls? Could they have legal rights? Was it legitimate to forcibly enslave them? Just as they have argued about the real attitudes of the conquistadors. Was it contempt, revulsion, or even grudging admiration for their adversaries? The real point is that at the key moments of decision, none of this mattered. Those making the decisions did not feel they were in control anyway. Those who were did not particularly care to know the details. To take a telling example, after the earliest years of gold and silver mines described by Motolinia, where millions of Indians were simply rounded up and marched off to their deaths, colonists settled on a policy of debt peonage, the usual trick of demanding heavy taxes, lending money at interest to those who could not pay, and then demanding that the loans be repaid with work. Royal agents regularly attempted to forbid such practices, arguing that the Indians were now Christian and that this violated their rights as loyal subjects of the Spanish crown. But, as with almost all such royal efforts to act as protector of the Indians, the result was the same. Financial exigencies ended up taking preference. Charles V himself was deeply in debt to banking firms in Florence, Genoa, and Naples, and gold and silver from the Americas made up perhaps one-fifth of his total revenue. In the end, despite a lot of initial noise, and usually quite sincere moral outrage on the part of the king's emissaries, such decrees were either ignored or, at best, enforced for a year or two, before being allowed to slip into abeyance. All of this helps explain why the Church had been so uncompromising in its attitude toward usury. It was not just a philosophical question. It was a matter of moral rivalry. Money always has the potential to become a moral imperative unto itself. Allow it to expand, and it can quickly become a morality so imperative that all others seem frivolous in comparison. For the debtor, the world is reduced to a collection of potential dangers, potential tools, and potential merchandise. Even human relations become a matter of cost-benefit calculation. Clearly, this is the way the conquistadors viewed the worlds that they set out to conquer. It is the peculiar feature of modern capitalism to create social arrangements that essentially force us to think this way. The structure of the corporation is a telling case in point, and it is no coincidence that the first major joint stock corporations in the world were the English and the Dutch East India Companies, ones that pursued the very same combination of exploration, conquest, and extraction as did the conquistadors. It is a structure designed to eliminate all moral imperatives but profit. The executives who make decisions can argue, and regularly do, that if it were their own money, of course they wouldn't fire lifelong employees a week before retirement or dump carcinogenic waste next to schools. Yet they are morally bound to ignore such considerations because they are mere employees whose only responsibility is to provide the maximum return on investment for the company's stockholders. And the stockholders, of course, are not given any say. The figure of Cortes is instructive for another reason. We are speaking of a man who, in 1521, had conquered a kingdom and was sitting atop a vast pile of gold. Neither did he have any intention of giving it away, even to his followers. 5 years later, he was claiming to be a penniless debtor. How was this possible? The obvious answer would be, Cortes was not a king. He was a subject of the King of Spain, living within the legal structure of a kingdom that insisted that, if he were not good at managing his money, he would lose it. Yet, as we've seen, the king's laws could be ignored in other cases. What's more, even kings were not entirely free agents. Charles V was continually in debt, and when his son Philip II, his armies fighting on three different fronts at once, attempted the old medieval trick of defaulting, all his creditors, from the Genoese Bank of St. George to the German Fuggers, to the Veslers, closed ranks to insist that he would receive no further loans until he started honouring his commitments. Capital, then, is not simply money. It is not even just wealth that can be turned into money, but neither is it just the use of political power to help use one's money to make more money. Cortes was trying to do exactly that. In classical Axial Age fashion, he was attempting to use his conquest to acquire plunder, and slaves to work the mines, with which he could pay his soldiers and suppliers cash to embark on even further conquests. It was a tried-and-true formula. But, for all the other conquistadors, it provided a spectacular failure. This would seem to mark the difference. In the Axial Age, money was a tool of empire. It might have been convenient for rulers to promulgate markets in which everyone would treat money as an end in itself. At times, rulers might even have come to see the whole apparatus of government as a profit-making enterprise. But money always remained a political instrument. This is why, when the empires collapsed and armies were demobilized, the whole apparatus could simply melt away. Under the newly emerging capitalist order, the logic of money was granted autonomy. Political and military power were then gradually reorganized around it.
And that's where we leave Chapter 11 for this week. This show and all previous episodes are available for download from the archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. The theme music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I hope this show has given you some perspective on the millennia-long process whereby human relations and human values have been eclipsed by the calculating nature of the amoral market. And I hope it's inspired you to get outside of the frame of the debate as prepared by the rich with their corporate-controlled media. I don't think any of this money is going to be worth a lot in a few years' time, so I'd encourage you to follow your heart, keep giving all you can, especially to those you love the most.